Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And in the first half of Exploration, once again, we're going to answer some of the emails that I get. I get hundreds of them. We'll be talking about, well, first of all, the weather. Is the weather going berserk? I mean, gigantic snowstorms and droughts in California. What's happening with the weather? Second, cancer. Why don't we have a cure for cancer? I mean, we know so much about genetics. We have the Human Genome Project. We have biotechnology. So what happened to the war on cancer? Why can't we simply cure it? And also, once again, I've been getting more emails concerning the imitation game. And the question, what is a Turing machine anyway? What's the big deal? Is the brain a Turing machine? And what light does it shed on the question of whether or not one day machines can become smarter than us? And then in the second half of Exploration, we're bringing our special guest, Dana McKenzie. He's written a book about, well, the moon. Think of it. You see the moon practically every night. And in its glory, it lights up the night sky. But where did it come from anyway? Well, for thousands of years, if not more, people have wondered about the origin of the moon. And in the last decade or so, most astronomers are converging on one theory about the origin of the moon that seems to fit all the data. So once again, we're going to be bringing on Dana McKenzie talking about the origin of the moon. Well, once again, in the first half of Exploration, let's answer some of the emails that I get. First of all, people are wondering about the weather. Have you noticed that we're getting 100-year snowstorms, 100-year droughts, 100-year forest fires? I mean, aren't they, by definition, supposed to happen once every 100 years? But they seem to be happening every few years. And what does that mean? Is it global warming? Is it human activity? Well, let's take a look at the temperature of the planet Earth. If you look at satellite data, if you look at ice cores, if you look at tree rings, lake sediments, many ways to compute this, you see that, first of all, the Earth is, in fact, heating up, and it's been accelerating in the last century. And then the question is, well, where's the controversy? Well, so far, almost everybody agrees, even the so-called skeptics of global warming, everybody agrees that the Earth is heating up. Maybe it's slowing down recently, but in the last 100 years, the temperature of the Earth is, in fact, heating up. So what's the debate? The debate is over what is driving it. It turns out that with 95% confidence, a vast majority of scientists, climatologists, meteorologists say that the Earth is heating up because of human activity. Now, there are some holdouts. However, most of the scientific community, citing the enormous amount of work done with computers, the enormous amount of work done with equations, are converging on the theory that, yes, indeed, it is human activity, specifically human activity that generates carbon dioxide. And then the question is, well, if it's human activity, and the vast majority of scientists believe so, then is that causing the berserk weather where we have forest fires, we have droughts, we have 100-year snowstorms? And the answer is, well, that gets a little bit hazy. You see, global warming is an average effect. That is, the temperature of the Earth, as well as climatic activity, they tend to oscillate. But they oscillate around a set point. That set point seems to be changing, and that's what's causing a lot of concern among climatologists. So can you say for certain, aha, this snowstorm, this forest fire, this drought is caused by global warming? And the answer is no. There's no one smoking gun. However, if you take a look at the average around which things oscillate, then you see that all the arrows point up. There's not a single arrow pointing down. All the arrows are pointing up. In terms of the temperature at the ice caps, the fact that Greenland, Alaska are beginning to thaw out, the fact that summers are getting longer around the planet Earth, the fact that swings in the weather are becoming more extreme. In other words, the Earth is heating up. There's more energy in the atmosphere. The energy has to go someplace, and it goes to creating swings. And then you may say, well, what about this polar vortex? I mean, if the Earth is heating up, how can we have more snow? Well, it turns out that there is a hurricane, so to speak, on the top of the North Pole. It's called the polar vortex. Normally, it's rather stable. It's sort of like a bucket of air that's spinning very rapidly. However, the stability of the polar vortex has been called into question. The temperature differential between the inside and the outside of the polar vortex has been disappearing slowly. And if you run computer simulations, you show that, yes, the polar vortex begins to wobble as a consequence. Think of a spinning top. It's not always stable. Sometimes the spinning top begins to slow down and starts to wobble. Well, there's been a lot of wobbling of the polar vortex, meaning that there's going to be more instability in the weather. And so once again, you cannot say that any one particular snowstorm, any one particular drought is caused by global warming. You have to look at the average effect. And when you look at the average effect, you see that, yes, all the glaciers on the planet Earth, all the major glaciers are receding. The huge areas of the planet Earth are thawing out, especially the tundra area of Siberia. And we see swings in the weather, such that you have droughts in California, and you have record rainfall on the Northeast. And then the last question is, what do we do about it? Is there going to be a point of no return beyond which we can't do anything at all? Well, there could be a series of points of no return. Many climatologists believe that we're gradually approaching the point at which there's so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that it will take maybe a century for natural processes to absorb it. And some people say, well, is there any example of a runaway greenhouse effect? And the answer is yes. Just look in the night sky. When the sun sets right above the sunset, you usually find Venus. Venus is the brightest object in the heavens other than the moon and the sun. And why is Venus so shiny? Well, it's because of its atmosphere. In fact, Venus is the hottest planet in the solar system, hotter than Mercury. The surface temperature of Venus is 800 degrees Fahrenheit. And why is that? Because Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect. Its atmosphere is almost 100% carbon dioxide, and it's much closer to the sun than the Earth. However, by rights, it has no reason to be at 800 degrees Fahrenheit, on average hotter than Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun. And the reason is there's a runaway greenhouse effect in Venus. Venus is the greenhouse planet. And so we have an example of what our future may look like in the coming centuries if this thing keeps on going out of control. And then another series of questions I often get on email is about medicine, specifically cancer. Didn't President Nixon declare war on cancer back in the 1970s? Some people say, well, maybe cancer won. So the question is, what is the problem? And the problem is that cancer is not specifically one disease. Cancer, more accurately speaking, can be viewed as a multitude of different kinds of mutations inside the cell. In fact, if you use the Human Genome Project and sequence the genes of cancer, first of all, you find out that cancer consists of hundreds, maybe thousands of tiny little mutations in the cell. So at first, it seems like it's hopeless to attack cancer. However, it turns out that if four major genes are disabled, very specific genes that control the reproduction of the cell, if they are disabled because of the gradual accumulation of hundreds of different kinds of mutations, then you can create cancer. And so there are ways now being proposed other than chemotherapy. Chemotherapy, of course, has horrible side effects. Your hair falls out, premature aging of the skin, you vomit, you're nauseous all the time. But that's because it's like a shotgun. We want a rifle that can isolate individual cancer cells, and there's several ways in which this might be done. One is gene therapy. Gene therapy is still in its infancy. And yet it's possible to insert so-called good genes into cells to perhaps stop them from proliferating. P53, for example. P53 is one of the major genes, when mutated, is involved with cancer. In fact, 50% of all common cancers usually involve a mutated version of the gene P53. So there are experiments, in fact, quite a few experiments being done on gene therapy to insert the good version of P53. So in other words, we're trying to repair damaged genes using gene therapy. Another way in which to attack the genes directly is by something called nanotechnology. it's now possible to take molecules, arm them with chemicals that are poisonous to cancer cells, and these cells home in on these cancer cells. And so we're using something called nanotechnology, the technology of molecules, to attack individual cancer cells. In fact, I had lunch last year with one of the scientists involved in this, and she told me that she has a grant from the government to pursue this research, but her test subjects are usually people that are, quote, hopeless, people that have not been cured by any known therapy. These are the hopeless ones that are going to die. These are the people that she experiments with them, and what does she do? She cures a lot of them. And so this is amazing, the fact that we can actually use nanotechnology, the technology of molecules, to home in on individual cancer cells, deposit poisons into them, and kill them. And then there's a whole bunch of other therapies being looked at, targeted therapies. Angiogenesis, for example, tries to choke off the blood supply of these cancer cells so they never form tumors. So angiogenesis gives us the possibility that maybe the tumor won't even form because the blood vessels cannot energize the tumor. And yet another one is to enhance the immune system. Doctors have taken blood from somebody's body, grew more immune cells, and then reinserted it back into the person so that they're recharged in some sense by having an immune system which is energized by artificial means from the outside. Well, does that mean we have a cure for cancer? And the answer is no. In fact, personally, I believe that we may never have one single cure for all cancers. I think just like the common cold, there are 300 different versions of rhinoviruses. And why don't we cure the common cold? Because it simply costs too much money to cure all 300. It's like a moving target, except you have 300 moving targets. The same thing with cancer. In other words, we may be able to cure some cancers outright. We may be able to, for the most part, stabilize most cancers so it's not such a deadly disease anymore. But one magic bullet that wipes out all cancers, that's going to be a long shot. And then another question, once again, I get a lot of questions about the imitation game. I referred to it last week. However, the imitation game talks about the life of Alan Turing. And the question is, well, how far can you push the Turing machines of Alan Turing? Alan Turing, as we mentioned before, was a scientist who invented something called the Turing machine. The Turing machine starts with a processor that can perform manipulations. You have an input tape and an output tape and a program. Now, that is a Turing machine, and that is the foundation of all of modern society today. The computers that we use, the very fact that you're listening to my voice, is a byproduct of the fact we have Turing machines and computers that process data. But you see, the human brain is not a Turing machine. We don't have a CPU. We don't have a Pentium chip. We don't have programming. We don't have software. None of the usual architectures of the Turing machines are found in the human brain. The human brain is something different. It's a neural network. It rewires itself after learning every task. And so it's not a static object. Your laptop, for example, is just as stupid today as it was yesterday. Your laptop never gets smarter. However, that's what neural networks do. They get smarter. Every time they learn something, they incorporate that into their network. Now, the human brain consists of 100 billion neurons, each neuron connected to 10,000 other neurons. That's a huge number of connections. But the strength of the different connections changes as you learn tasks. And so the brain does not, in some sense, physically rewire itself, but it rewires itself by changing how easily pathways can flow in the brain. In other words, practice, practice, practice. That's the key to success. That's the key to going to Carnegie Hall, and that's the key to success. And there's a reason for that. That's called Hebb's rule. Hebb's rule says that every time you make a task and you do it correctly, that task would be reinforced. And so the next time, it's easier to do that task, and that is called learning. And that's the difference between a neural network and a Turing machine. And so how far can you push Turing machines? Well, scientists have tried to create Turing machines that can think like us, but they have failed. That's a top-down approach. Our human brain is simply too complicated, and we know too many laws of common sense that robots do not know. Robots don't know that water is wet, strings can pull, strings cannot push, mothers are older than their daughters. Things that we consider common sense, well, robots don't know at all. And that's why learning machines eventually could become the major paradigm by which we begin to analyze machines that can learn, machines that could become intelligent. So as you see, we have a long ways to go before we can mimic the human brain. For example, the reactor at Fukushima, you think, would be the ideal place to put a robot. It's simply too radioactive at Fukushima for a human to go in many delicate places. So why not send in a robot? Well, that's the problem. Robots do not know how to navigate in a field of debris. They cannot turn a screwdriver. They cannot use a hammer. They cannot turn a valve. All the simple things that you would want a robot to do if you have a nuclear power plant accident as in Fukushima. Well, the next set of questions that I get concerns space travel. And some people ask the question, well, why can't we go into outer space to colonize Mars, colonize the universe? What's in store for the space program? I mean, all those science fiction novels, were they all just bogus, making up all these fanciful tales about conquering the universe? Well, let's talk about the space program. First of all, why is it so expensive? It's haunted by a four-letter word, cost, C-O-S-T. It takes about $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit, just spinning around the Earth, $10,000 a pound, that's your weight in gold. Now, to go to the moon, it would cost about $100,000 per pound to put you on the moon. Now, and to put you on Mars would cost about $1 million a pound. So in other words, your weight in gold would be sufficient to put you into orbit around the Earth. But for you to go to Mars, it would take your weight in diamonds in order to put you on the red planet. So immediately you begin to realize, oh my God, this is really an expensive proposition. And then when you think about the stars, then you begin to realize, my God, can chemical rockets even go that far? For example, people have seen the recent movie Interstellar. Matthew McConaughey zaps across the galaxies, in fact, to encounter black holes and wormholes. I mean, is that preposterous for human beings to do something like this? Well, let's take a Saturn rocket. A Saturn rocket used to be our most powerful booster rocket. And let's shoot it into space and let it keep on going. Saturn rockets usually don't burst with energy more than about, 5 minutes or so. But let's just keep on burning the fuel. It turns out that if you go on a Saturn rocket to the stars, it would take about 70,000 years. 70,000 years, traveling at roughly 25,000 miles per hour to reach the nearby stars. And so you begin to realize that, hey, we need a new propulsion system. And that's why NASA set up a study group called the 100-Year Starship. And that's about right. I think in about 100 years' time, we may have technologies that might take us to the nearby stars. And so you can begin to realize how far away and distant this proposition is. Now, first of all, you may say to yourself, well, why even bother? Well, the reason for doing this is because one day we will have to leave the Earth. In 5 billion years, the sun will exhaust its fuel and eat up the Earth. On a scale of tens of millions of years, another meteor or comet that can kill life on Earth could impact on this planet. On a scale of thousands of years, we're going to have another ice age. And perhaps on a scale of decades, we face the problem of global warming. And so for all these reasons, it's inevitable that we either leave the Earth or at some point die on the planet Earth. So then the question is, what kind of propulsion system do we need to take us to the stars? Well, we don't have any at the present time. However, several have been proposed. One is the nuclear rocket. That is, having small mini nuclear bombs thrown out the back end of your rocket ship like tiny little nuclear firecrackers. Each nuclear firecracker gives you a boost, and then you literally ride on the tidal wave, created by a succession of tiny little nuclear firecrackers that you eject from the exhaust. Well, it seems such a preposterous idea, but if you do the math, it turns out that you could probably reach maybe half the speed of light using this method. So why not? Well, there's a problem. There's a big problem with this. And that is, first of all, you're dealing with nuclear technology, the technology of miniaturization. And that means that anyone who perfects this kind of technology can also use it to create designer hydrogen warheads. In other words, nuclear blackmail. Let's say that a terrorist group gets access to a suitcase hydrogen bomb by which they can detonate an entire city. I mean, think about it. These mini nukes, these tiny little nuclear weapons can create havoc if they fall into the wrong hands. Well, this was called the Orion Project, and by golly, at least on paper, it might actually work. A starship using nuclear pellets to propel itself to the stars. Well, the physicist who was the main proponent behind it was Ted Taylor. Ted Taylor was an acquaintance of mine, and he had the distinction of being the designer of much of our nuclear arsenal. That's right, he was a bomb designer. He worked for the United States Pentagon. He used his formidable skills in nuclear physics to design the hydrogen bombs and atomic bombs of our nuclear arsenal. For example, the Davy Crockett, a small portable nuclear bomb, was designed by Ted Taylor. He had the rare distinction of also creating the fission bomb that had the largest output of any bomb detonated during the Cold War. Well, he was behind the Orion Project because he thought it was a way for nuclear weapons to be used peacefully to take us to the stars. Well, then one day I asked Ted. I said, Ted, hey, you're the guy who essentially designed most of our nuclear warheads. You're the guy who was the main force behind the Orion Project. So why did you quit? And then he said, well, honestly, he had a turn of heart, because he began to realize that these bombs he was working on, that is small mini nukes, could be used for terrorism. You see, there are three generations of hydrogen warheads. The first generation in the 1950s, they were huge, gigantic monsters. They were about 15 feet long. They weighed many tons, and they were so big they could barely fit in the bomb bay of a bomber. That was the first generation. The second generation hydrogen bombs were MIRVs. That is, you could put maybe 10 of them inside the nose cone of a single rocket. And then third generation hydrogen bombs are designer hydrogen bombs that can be used anywhere, anytime, in the desert, in outer space, underground, all-purpose designer hydrogen warheads. That's the third generation, and that's what he was working on. That's what he did professionally, to go from the first to the second and then third generation hydrogen bombs. But then one day it dawned on him that one day, if it's so easy to create this technology, then hey, maybe someday a terrorist could get access to the technology and all hell breaks loose. At that point, he quit. He said to himself, no, I cannot continue to work on this project in good faith, knowing that the end product of this could be nuclear annihilation. Well, yet another proposal being circulated that I personally think is promising is the ramjet fusion engine. Instead of using fission power, that is the power of uranium, which creates meltdowns and all sorts of nuclear waste, why not use fusion, the fusion of hydrogen? Make it a ramjet fusion engine so it literally breathes the hydrogen inside outer space. Here's how it would work. Think of an ice cream cone. An ice cream cone that moves in the forward direction, scooping up interstellar hydrogen as it moves forward. Then it concentrates the hydrogen toward the back of the ice cream cone, heats it up, fuses it so that it creates energy, and then helium gas shoots out the other end. Now, because there's almost a limitless supply of hydrogen gas out there in outer space, because after all, that's what the universe is made of, then there's an infinite supply of fuel. And therefore, in some sense, this rocket will go on forever, forever. And so you turn it on, and it simply continually accelerates until it reaches near the speed of light. In fact, there's even a science fiction story where the first one of these ramjet fusion engines is built. It accelerates and then has a malfunction. It's stuck in autopilot, so it just keeps on accelerating. And you can't stop it. You can't stop it because it scoops up basically an unlimited supply of hydrogen in the forward direction. And as it begins to reach the speed of light, Einstein's time distortion starts to come into play. Time slows down inside the rocket ship. So the universe ages naturally, but the people inside have stopped aging. And so from their point of view, the aging of the universe speeds up. And so they witness the formation of stars, the formation of galaxies, the death of stars, the death of galaxies, as they rocket out of control, going faster and faster and faster, getting closer and closer to the speed of light. And in the final end of this novel, these astronauts witness the creation of another universe. Because they first of all witness the death of our universe. In the novel, the universe begins to contract. Temperatures begin to rise, and they are able to go right through the big crunch and witness the birth of the next universe. Well, of course, that's pretty far-fetched, but at least in principle, it does seem to obey some of the laws of physics. Well, yet another entry into the sweepstakes to build the first starship in about 100 years is the antimatter engine. Any fan of Star Trek knows that the basic energy supply of the warp drive comes from matter, antimatter. Well, antimatter does exist. It is the opposite of matter, and when it combines with matter, all hell breaks loose. It creates an enormous amount of energy. A teaspoon of antimatter would be sufficient to basically detonate and destroy any modern city like a hydrogen bomb. Now, but it turns out that antimatter is not so exotic. In fact, I played with antimatter when I was in high school. When I was in high school, I built a cloud chamber with a magnetic field and actually proved that I could take pictures of the trails of antimatter moving in a cloud chamber. And later, I actually designed an atom smasher to try to create antimatter of my own rather than using sodium-22, which is a radioactive source for positrons or positive electrons. Well, PET scans in hospitals, they use antimatter. The PET allows you to take gorgeous photographs of the thinking brain. The P stands for positron, and that is a positive electron. And so even in hospitals, we can use this technology to create antimatter. So in an antimatter rocket, you would essentially place antimatter inside a chamber. You don't want the chamber to hit the outside because it would blow the whole thing up. But as you have antimatter come in contact with matter, it releases energy which in turn can heat up chemicals, which are then thrust out one end, giving you perhaps one of the most efficient ways of generating energy. But again, these technologies, well, they're about 100 years away. Sorry about that. Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we're going to bring on Data McKenzie talking about something that, well, everyone has wondered about at a certain point or another, and that is the moon. Where did the moon come from anyway? Well, astronomers and scientists are converging on one theory about the origin of perhaps one of the most familiar and mysterious objects in the heavens, and that is the moon. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In this part of Exploration, we're going to bring on our special guest, Dana McKenzie, who's the author of a new book that probes a question that perhaps everyone's asked themselves at some point or another, and that is, where did the moon come from? Believe it or not, there are many theories about the origin of the moon, but recently, all these theories have seemed to coalesce into a unified theory of the origin of the moon. So once again, our special guest today is Dana McKenzie, talking about where the moon came from. Now I'd like to bring on our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Dr. Dana McKenzie. He's a mathematician and now a science writer, and he got intrigued by the whole question of the moon. Where did the moon come from? Why do we need a moon? Where is the moon going? The ancients speculated about the origin of the moon, and now we have hard scientific data about the origin of our nearest celestial neighbor. And today we're going to be talking about his latest book. It's called The Big Splat. That's the theory that says that billions of years ago, an asteroid about the size of Mars plowed into the planet Earth, and out of the debris, crystallized our moon. So once again, our special guest today is Dana McKenzie, author of the book The Big Splat, and today we are talking about the origin of the moon. How did you first get interested in the so-called Big Splat theory?
Yeah. Okay. So, well, the way I got interested in this was that I went to a conference on the Earth and the Moon, on the origin of the Earth and Moon in Monterey in 1998. Actually, I covered this conference for Science Magazine, which I write for pretty often. And I went to this conference and was very struck by the fact that everybody there was talking about something called the giant impact theory. The giant impact theory is what moon scientists actually call it. The big splat is what I call it in my book because I needed a fancier title. Now, you can't write a book called The Giant Impact. It sounds boring, but The Big Splat sounds more exciting. So, but if you actually go up to a moon scientist and talk about it, the giant impact is what they call it. Anyway, so there are about 100 moon scientists and planetary scientists at this meeting. They all talk about the giant impact theory as if everybody knows what the giant impact theory is. You know, of course, you know what that is. That's just, you know, that's the way the moon formed. And there's really not that much debate about it. And this stunned me because I had never heard of it. Even though I consider myself a fairly scientifically literate person, and, you know, as a science journalist, it's kind of my job to know about things. And I hadn't heard about this theory. And so... So right away, that kind of raised my antennas a little bit, and I said, wow, you know, somehow they haven't gotten the message out there about this theory. You know, here's this big question that we went to the moon to find out, you know, where did the moon come from? That was one of the big scientific objectives of the Apollo mission. And here they're saying, we found out the answer. And yet, they haven't managed to tell the public what they found out.
Okay, well, let's get right into that now. Now, everyone has a theory of the moon. We see it practically every night. Right. The ancients had theories of the moon. So talk to us a little bit about how the ancients viewed the moon, starting perhaps the Greeks and other ancient societies.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an interesting question because the ancients, a lot of them didn't know what to make of the moon. Some people thought it was something that was in our atmosphere. You know, other people thought it was a hole in the cosmos that is this hole that you can look through and see, you know, the heavens beyond or something like that. There were many theories. I think that the two very important theories to know about are, first of all, the Aristotelian theory, which dominated the Western viewpoint for literally 1,500 years or so, which viewed the heavens as these perfect, incorruptible things that the planets and the stars all, you know, lived out there, and as I said, they're considered to be made of some different substance, something they call it the quintessence, and you had this. So, and one of the key things about this theory is that the Earth is at the center of the universe in this theory, and that all these other things are sort of ranged around the Earth, and the Earth is sort of viewed as where all the bad things are, you know, the corruptible things that decay and die and stuff like that. And the heavens are out there and perfect. And so this, as I said, this dominated Western thought for centuries. People thought that the Earth was at the center of the universe. What's interesting is that that was not the only theory. Even in the era of the ancient Greeks, there were some people, there's a Greek astronomer named Aristarchus, who actually posited the idea that the sun was at the center of the universe, and actually came up with the idea very much like what we now call the Copernican system. And in that theory, when, you know, he actually saw, you know, the sun as being the center of the universe and the planets as being Earth-like bodies that orbited around the sun. And so in this theory, the moon was something that was not so different from the Earth. It was just a piece of rock up there in the sky. And, of course, nowadays, that's what we know it is. So they were right. At the time of the Greeks, you know, no one knew. There was no way to find out. What's interesting is that there was this very vigorous debate during the time of the ancient Greeks. But the sort of the prestige and power of Aristotle eventually sort of turned the debate into a very one-sided argument.
You know, it seems fascinating to me that the Greeks actually calculated the distance between the Earth to the Moon.
Yes, they did a number of remarkable things. They could calculate the radius of the Earth, and they worked out the distance from the Earth to the Moon. I believe they had some idea, perhaps, of the distance to the Earth from the Earth to the Sun, although I don't know how accurate they were on that.
It's absolutely amazing to me that the Greeks could do those two calculations, the size of the Earth and the distance to the Moon. Mm-hmm. And they did it using just basically string and a protractor by looking at shadows around the ancient world at noontime at a certain time of the year.
Right.
Not all shadows are the same. Therefore, the Earth must be curved. And they could actually calculate the distance, the radius of the Earth by looking at the different shadows of the planet Earth.
It's actually very mathematical. It's basic trigonometry.
And then looking at eclipses, comparing the solar eclipse to the lunar eclipse, and the fact that two are different, but both of them involve the moon, they could then calculate the distance between the Earth and the moon.
That's right. Again, it's sort of trigonometry, and we're kind of lucky, actually, that the moon is just at the right distance where during a total eclipse, it just eclipses the sun. Not too big and not too small, but just right.
Let's talk about Galileo and the telescope. With the proliferation of the telescope, we could see craters on the moon. And how did that influence our thinking about the oceans of the moon? When we look at maps of the moon, we see mare this, mare this, mare as in mariner, as in oceans.
Yeah.
So how did the telescope affect things?
Yeah, well, the 1600s were a very interesting time. So you had the telescope being invented about 1609, and Galileo heard about it and actually built his own telescope, which was the best telescope of its day, like 1610, 1611, or so forth. And the first thing he looked at was the moon, because that's the most obvious thing to look at in the night sky. And if your listeners haven't ever done this, you really should do it. Look at the moon through a telescope, because it just looks completely different. When you look at the moon with the naked eye, there's basically, it looks kind of flat, and there's technical reasons for this. But when you look at it through a telescope, you can really see the curvature, and immediately you can just tell this is not, you know, a flat hole in the sky, you know, or it's not, you know, some celestial sphere orbiting up there like Aristotle said. You can tell that it's a world. And so So when people look through the telescopes, they can see this. And, of course, the first assumption was it's a world like ours. And so you see these, as you said, the mares, which is in the Latin word for sea. And the first theory that people had was that these were actual bodies of water. And so they named them that. And, in fact, there was a big race in the 1600s to name all the features on the moon. And some people named them after, had one naming scheme, people. There's sort of a Catholic Church naming scheme, and then there's sort of a English naming scheme, and eventually they settled on naming features in Latin. So that's why we have things like Mare Tranquillitatis, which is the Sea of Tranquility. That's where the first moon landing was.
And these mares are actually, as I understand, lava flows,
volcanoes
covered up.
So it became evident to scientists fairly early on that they really were not seas of water. But, of course, they didn't know what they were exactly. They're just, for some reason, darker than the rest of the moon rocks. And so we didn't really know for sure what they were until we went to the moon on the Apollo missions. And the first mission was to one of these seas.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that in a minute. But tell us a little bit about Kepler and also the son of Charles Darwin. They also had theories about the moon.
Well, Kepler was an interesting person to write about. One of the fun things about writing a book is that it evolves sometimes in ways you hadn't expected. I've always been a big fan of Galileo, and so I had sort of expected to write a big chapter about Galileo and how important his discoveries were for the moon and so forth. And what I found out was, well, really, Galileo didn't have that much to say about the moon. He wrote this one fabulous little pamphlet about it, and then went on to other things. He got more interested in the moons of Jupiter, and he, of course, was interested in the whole this whole solar system and so forth. So he didn't really actually say that much about the moon. But Kepler sort of was haunted by the moon his whole life, and he actually wrote the what some people consider the first work of science fiction, which is called Somnium, the Dream. And this dream is actually a dream about a voyage to the moon. And what's interesting about this, ostensibly science fiction, is that it actually has a huge amount of science fact behind it. And it's just a marvelous compendium of what was known scientifically about the moon then and so forth. And, of course, Kepler was very much a proponent of the idea that the moon is another world. And he envisioned what it would be like to be on this other world. And, for example, he came up with all sorts of interesting facts, but one thing that he realized, which I'm not sure if most people realize now, is that if you're on the moon, you don't see the Earth rise and set. The Earth stays in the same spot in the sky, and that's because the Earth is tidally locked the moon is tidally locked to the Earth, so it doesn't rotate relative to the Earth. So you always see the Earth in the same point in the sky. Kepler figured this out. I don't think anyone knew that before. And so actually when the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, the Apollo 8 astronauts orbited the moon and took this wonderful picture of Earth rise above the moon. And I think people, probably thought of that as being just like sunrise. Well, actually, the reason they saw Earth rise was because they were going around the moon, and they come around the backside of the moon and they see the Earth on the other side. But actually, the Earth doesn't rise over the moon. The Earth just stays there.
In fact, when we talk about the man in the moon, or people in Asia talk about the rabbit in the moon, it's the same devil moon. We never see the backside of the moon.
Yeah, we don't see the backside.
Yeah, because of the fact that one side is locked onto the planet Earth because of something called tidal forces.
That's right. And that is where we get to start to talk about Charles Darwin's son. And here's another one of these sort of unexpected heroes of my book. I mean, everybody knows about Charles Darwin, but very few people nowadays realize that he was actually the father of a tremendous, marvelous scientific family, that his son, George Darwin, was the greatest expert on tides in the late 1800s. And he also had a son, Francis Darwin, who was a very noted naturalist in his time. Both of these sons were made knights of the British Empire, just like Charles Darwin was. And in fact, around the turn of the century, George Darwin was one of the most famous scientists in the world. Now people have sort of forgotten about him. But one of the things I hopefully have done in my book is kind of bring him back into the limelight a little bit. He was the first person to propose a scientifically based theory for the origin of the moon. And his, because he was such an expert on tides, his theory was actually based on tidal motion. But what he realized is that there are tides on the moon very much as there are on the Earth. And in fact, the Earth has a much stronger tidal effect on the moon than the moon does on the Earth. And so, in fact, the Earth has locked the moon into position. It's not able to rotate sort of independently the way the Earth does. And it creates a bulge in the moon, just the same way that the moon creates a bulge in the Earth. Now, what George Darwin realized was that the tidal bulge in the Earth, because the Earth is not locked to the moon, the Earth is rotating, and the Earth rotates faster about its axis than the moon rotates about the Earth. So when the Earth rotates, its tidal bulge is always getting ahead of the moon, okay, because the Earth's rotation is faster. And so this bulge is actually pulling the moon forward. It's always tugging the moon forward in its orbit. And so you might think this would make the moon go faster and faster, but that's not actually what happens. When you learn a little bit of Newtonian mechanics, what actually happens when you tug a planet faster in its orbit is it moves out. Okay, so the moon is gradually moving away from the Earth. And George Darwin named this effect tidal friction. And he based this entirely on pure physics, on the pure physics and mathematics. And it's very interesting because, you know, he had no way of directly verifying this. But one of the things that the Apollo astronauts did when they went to the moon, the first mission, is put a reflector on the moon so you could shine a laser beam at this reflector and look at the way, you know, shine it to the reflector, have it bounce back to the Earth, and actually directly measure how quickly is the moon moving away from the Earth.
Okay, let's say a few things about Newtonian physics.
Sure.
Now, okay? Newton in the 1600s came out with the definitive laws of gravity,
right,
which binds the solar system together. And he also calculated the allowed trajectories, including circles, ellipses, hyperbolas, parabolas, but there are no spirals. In free space, in empty space with no friction,
sure,
spirals are not allowed as a solution of Newton's laws of motion. Therefore, capture was not possible. It's simply physically, mathematically, scientifically not possible for a single Earth in outer space to capture a solitary moon without friction, like air friction, and there's no air in outer space.
Right.
So we can actually use Newton's laws of motion to rule out one of the main theories,
yeah,
of the origin of the moon.
Well, you would think so. But nevertheless, the capture theory was one of the three main theories going into the Apollo missions.
Right, because people didn't understand the laws of physics.
Yeah. Well, let me just step back for one second and say that the first theory was George Darwin's theory, which was called the fission theory. And so where that came from, so basically his idea of where the moon came from was that it just spun off the Earth. Okay, the Earth was spinning much more rapidly, and the moon flew off the Earth. And the way he arrived at this theory was basically by running the tidal friction scenario in reverse. So basically he saw that the moon is receding from the Earth now, and he said, okay, if I run the movie in reverse, it had to be moving towards the Earth back, if we run the movie in reverse. And so eventually when you go back to the beginning, you have the moon actually at the Earth. So that's where he got the so-called fission theory. So that was the first scientifically based theory of the moon's origin. The second one historically to be proposed was the capture theory. And as you say, the capture theory, a priori, if you know Newtonian physics, seems to be impossible. Okay? Now, there's a caveat you put in there, though, which is that without friction, you cannot have a spiral orbit. But if you put in some friction, then you could have a capture. And so this is very implausible, admittedly, but one of the first proponents of the capture theory suggested that maybe the interstellar medium actually has some kind of resisting stuff in it. That the guy who proposed this was a very colorful guy named Thomas Jefferson Jackson C., an American, very self-promoting, self-aggrandizing guy, who was one of the first American astronomers to get a PhD in Europe. He was a somewhat well-respected guy in his time, but he had some really wild ideas. And one of these ideas was the idea that there was something out there in the interstellar medium that resisted motion and then enabled the moon to be captured by the Earth. Very quickly, that theory became less respectable scientifically. But still, there were people who argued for some version of the capture, where maybe you had a lot of debris around the Earth early in the formation of the solar system, and that debris could slow something down enough to be captured.
Okay. Well, now let's get to the Apollo space program, because you've been alluding to it.
Yeah.
What did the Apollo space program show in terms of moon rocks? What are moon rocks made of?
Right. Okay. Well, so what's interesting about moon rocks is they're a lot like Earth rocks, but there are some subtle differences. So one of the things, for example, one of the ways they're a lot like Earth rocks is they looked at things like isotope ratios. And so, for example, they look at different isotopes, meaning different weights of the various elements. So, for example, you can look at oxygen, and there's a version of oxygen that's very common, and then there's some heavier versions. And these ratios in moon rocks look identical to Earth rocks. So this is a hint that the moon, wherever it formed, probably formed somewhere similar in the solar system to where the Earth did. On the other hand, there are some differences. In moon rocks, you don't see what are called volatile elements. These are elements that have low boiling points. And so one that this posed a problem for some of the theories of the moon. Okay, the theory that the moon is called co-accretion theory, the theory that the moon just sort of grew up in the same part of the solar system that the Earth did and accreted the same way as Earth did, has a problem with it because that doesn't explain why you have this lack of volatile elements. And third, another huge difference between the moon and the Earth is that the Earth has almost no core to it. In fact,
the moon has no core to it.
Yeah.
You said the Earth. Yeah.
So the Earth has a huge core. The Earth has the biggest core of any planet other than Mercury.
Iron core.
The moon, yes, and this core is made of iron and nickel, too, and some heavy elements, but mostly iron. Whereas the moon has a very small core. It's been estimated now at about 2% of the weight of the moon, whereas the Earth's core is about 33% of its weight. So again, if you have the Earth and moon growing up in the same part of the solar system, why does one of them get all the iron and the other gets almost none? It makes no sense. So basically, what you had is this strange situation where there are three theories for the moon, and none of them really made sense. You know, you have this capture theory that makes very little sense because of Newtonian physics. You have to really stretch to get, you know, some way to capture the Earth. You have this co-accretion theory, which made sense before we went to the moon, but now all of a sudden we see these differences between the moon rocks and the Earth rocks. And you have George Darwin's fission theory, which also had troubles with it on physical grounds. So you had three theories of the moon, and none of them seem to make sense.
Okay,
and
now
so that's where you get a fourth theory.
Okay, now let's talk about the Big Splat theory. What are some of the convincing reasons for believing in the Big Splat?
Right. Well, so there's basically the Big Splat accounts for some of these things that were discovered in the Apollo program. First of all, this volatile depletion that I talked about, the lack of volatile elements. Well, if you have a moon forming by a giant impact, a catastrophic impact between Earth and another planet, that will blow off a lot of stuff into orbit and some stuff out into space. And what gets blown off preferentially into space is the stuff that has low boiling point. So the Big Splat accounts very nicely for why you don't see volatiles in the moon rocks. Second thing, the iron core. Where did the moon's iron core go? Well, the Big Splat actually turns out to explain this very nicely, that when you have this collision, the planet that runs into the Earth is basically destroyed. It's completely destroyed. Some of it's vaporized. A lot of it is liquefied. And the heavier elements tend to go into the Earth's core. It's the lighter stuff that tends to go into orbit. So again, the Big Splat explains the difference in the cores very nicely, and you can actually do computer simulations that show it works this way. And then one other piece of evidence, which was unknown before the Apollo missions, one of probably the biggest scientific discovery of the Apollo missions was the discovery that the moon once was covered by an ocean of magma. That's molten rock, about 600 kilometers deep. And so we have evidence, and I could talk about what the evidence is if you want. But we have this direct evidence from the moon rocks that the moon surface was once molten. What provided the energy to melt the moon? Okay, again, the giant impact theory explains this very nicely, because you have this incredibly energetic collision. You have all this stuff being blown into orbit. You have the Earth with a ring of debris around it for maybe a year or maybe 100 years, just like Saturn. But this debris coalesces very rapidly and forms the moon. And this rapid coalescence is a very violent process. You've got stuff falling into this growing moon and basically melting the rocks. You know, the rocks hit each other, they get heated up, and eventually the outer layer melts. So again, the Big Splat accounts for this molten layer, this magma ocean, where none of the other theories really do. So there's no one thing that says we had this giant impact, but there's a series of things that, you know, bit by bit add up to making this seem more plausible.
Well, personally, I like to say that what I find interesting about the story of the origin of the moon is that it shows you how scientists work. And that is, we start with making hypotheses about the origin of the moon, but hey, that's not enough. Then you got to look at the data. You got to look at the numbers. And now, of course, we have theories. We have the theory of Isaac Newton. We have modern chemistry. We have aeronautics, by which we can then begin to use computers to simulate these scenarios. And so, in other words, this is the scientific method in action. We propose lots of ideas. We then try to look at these ideas and see whether they correlate with data. But now we have computers. And with computers, we can do simulations of these things. And on the web, you can actually see some of these simulations where we take the moon and we take the Earth, run the videotape backwards, and then try to fill in the gaps about where the moon actually came from. And if you assume that there was an object about the size of Mars that plowed into the Earth, you can then simulate that cosmic explosion and then recreate the origin of the moon right inside the memory of a computer. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. You can also follow me on Twitter. I have over 330,000 people on Twitter, or on Facebook. I have 2.3 million fans on Facebook. And so once again, this has been Exploration.